Hey, guess who's back with season five? This is season five of Victims of Fun. This is El Stevo, your host, and we are back in Florida after a long, long time being based in Tokyo. We are back in Florida. And right now, I am on a beach, well, at a beach place here in Florida, on the Gulf Coast side, actually. And they're playing some music at this place I'm at, and hopefully it's not messing the audio up. And it's a beautiful sunny day. We hear waves hitting the sand, and we are back in Florida. I'm working on my tan. It was a very hectic move, to say the least. All my personal belongings are still being shipped over because, you know, I have enough room. You know, back in the old days, you could put all your luggage on a plane and just go, and now, you know, you can't. Now, a lot of airlines charge you for carry-on. Back in the old days, they didn't do that, but, you know, they gotta make money, and all the COVID stuff going on, they're trying to make as much money as they can, and yeah, whatever. I had the whole plane almost to myself anyway, so not bad. And, so, like, a lot of my stuff is in a secure FedEx, kind of, not a container, but, like, a big trunk type. The box is pretty big. It costs a lot of money to ship it back over, but, you know, I need all my stuff back. But the important stuff I brought with me, you know, the laptop from Apple, my blue Yeti Snowball microphone, my Seagate SSD drive, I brought all that as my carry-on. With a couple clothing items just to get me, you know, I still had some stuff here, but the important thing was to make sure I did not lose any of the equipment I need to do the podcast, and everything else is coming in the box. And I got back here, and I've been back for a few days, and that's why we haven't been down in the air for a while, because, you know, I told everybody at the end of season four I had to take some time off to get the move back in here. So, you know, we're back in the United States, and thank you. I'm back, you know, with Anchor, as usual, the best podcasting system on the planet. If you want to mail me, email me at victimsoffun@mail.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, and Facebook. No, wait, we're not on Snapchat. Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. By just searching for Victims of Fun and following us. There's no reason to put us on Snapchat. I mean, it's just me sitting at the, you know, in front of all the equipment. Yeah, I'm not gonna run two Snapchat accounts. I have my own personal one. I'm not giving that out to anybody. And so here we are at the Gulf side in Florida. Beautiful out. I had a nice blackened grouper sandwich for lunch, and a nice Greek caviar with pita bread, which is fantastic. My blackened grouper, Greek style coffee, it was fantastic. Might do a sushi tomorrow. Not entirely sure yet. I don't know. Still getting everything situated, but it's been beautiful weather, and right now I'm here at this beach place, and got myself a mojito right here. Very refreshing. I have a nice Cuban cigar. I'm doing the podcast. So the move was just, it's moving is a lot of work. I remember, after my father passed away, my mother moved to Florida, driving the moving van down here. That was pretty hectic. You know, I was always worried about destroying the furniture in the van, and I'd never driven anything that big before. I've told you this story before, but this wasn't as bad, because, you know, all my important stuff I had on my carry-on. And, you know, FedEx, you know, they're very good. That's why I went with FedEx, because it's point to point. So they came and they picked up my chest of stuff, and they took it, and it'll be handed off and then brought here. It's supposed to be here Saturday. And but you know, you can track it or anything else. And FedEx doesn't lose stuff, because in this thing, when I'm having shipped over, at least the chest or the box or whatever you want to call it, it doesn't get passed off to a third party. This is something FedEx directly, you pay for it. But I want to make sure it gets here, because there's some clothing stuff and some stuff I've collected, some Godzilla figures, and you know, my sake set with the real sake bowl and the real sake cup and my really good chopsticks and a couple other things. No, I did not smuggle a Japanese girl in there, though that would have been fantastic. Ugh. But so I'm back in the United States, and it's a bit of a culture shock. I mean, yeah, this is the country of my birth and where I lived most of my life, but when you've lived overseas for a while and you come back, it's a bit of a culture shock, and you start looking for things and that, you know, oh yeah, that's right, you know, they don't sell that here. Or, oh, yep, wait, they don't do that here. And you gotta, I'm pretty much back adjusted to it, but when you walk in for the first time, and God knows how long, and you're like, okay, I'm back. The milk is different, the food's different. I remember when I lived in Europe, the milk was all in boxes, because it was pasteurized, it was treated with something, and it had a shelf life of like forever, and it was in boxes, and you didn't refrigerate it, you didn't have to, and it would stay good for God knows how long. And that, to me, I was like, what the heck is this? And after a while, you get used to it. And then, you know, over there, they don't really do the coffee maker thing, like the Mr. Coffee thing, like in Prague back then they didn't. And so you either had instant coffee, or you did it Greek Turkish style, which was basically the coffee grinds right in the coffee. But I got myself a French press, because I always said that a French press was the best way to make coffee anyway. So, you know, that's what I did. And, but, you know, so you come over here and you expect things to be a little bit chaotic until you get used to it. I mean, one of the first things I noticed when I got back is that the bathrooms here are so much bigger than, I mean, where I was in Tokyo, I had one of those little Leo apartment things, which are small, you know, it's a studio. And, but, you know, it was just me, so it's no big deal. You know, it's kind of nice. I lived in a nice area, had some nice neighbors, the apartment was gorgeous, and, you know, you walked in, you took your shoes off, and, you know, at least in my apartment, when you walked in, on our right-hand side, you had a little closet where you put your shoes, and then you walked down a little bit, and in my apartment on the right was, I guess you would say, the kitchen area. I had their refrigerator there, which was not an American refrigerator. It was a one-door fridge. It was maybe about 3 feet, maybe 4 feet high. Inside of it was a freezer area. And then next to it was the sink, and I had, I was lucky, instead of a two-burner gas or two-burner electric, I had two-burner induction, which was cool. And I had water, and storage underneath and over it, and then you had a little area for your rice maker, and, I had a little microwave toaster oven thing. And to your left was the wet bathroom, which had your washing machine in it. And, well, actually, no, my washing machine was to the left of my wet bathroom. So your wet bathroom is, you go in and you have your toilet and your shower area, and it was like a little mini tub, and then you had the shower thing there. And it was all like one room, and you would have your washing machine, and you would wash your clothes, and you put them in the bathroom because the bathroom had a heater lamp thing, which in a little clothesline thing that went across, you pulled out from the wall and connected to the other side of the wall, and that's where you hung your clothes. And the toilet seat actually had a heater on it. Yeah, you could adjust the flow of, I guess, the wash, the flow when you flush it, and then it had a bidet, which you could adjust the flow on that. I guess you don't want to rip your colon to shreds. And the toilet seat had a heater, and you could adjust it on those cold Tokyo days. Believe me, it gets cold in Japan. And it was nice. And then you would walk, and there was a door, and you open the door, and that was the main living area of the apartment. And you walk in, and some of them had lofts, but I'm not good with climbing because my knees are kind of shot. So I had one where you went up like four steps, and there was your bed, so it was elevated, but it was only elevated like, well, on me, it was just up to my chest. So it wasn't a loft, but you went up like four steps to get in your bed. And then there was your bed. And then, but the good thing about that is underneath your bed, you had all the storage. And I used to joke, like, you know, I could throw a mattress under here and then somebody could, like, just sleep in there. But so I had, you know, storage in there. And then I had a table, a couple chairs, and, you know, all the laptop, the Apple was there, all the Victims of Fun stuff was there, and then, you know, I would throw it in the bag and go to the ramen shop to do the podcast, but then the rest of the time it was in the apartment. And then you had very good internet in the apartment, and very high-speed internet, and you had your cable TV, and you had a couple American channels, but most of it was Japanese. And let me tell you something, Japanese television is absolutely the greatest thing in the world. You really, if you have a Roku or an Amazon Fire Stick, you can actually download some apps that have, like, just Japanese television and watch it. It's, like, the greatest thing. Like, seriously, just leave it on any of the broadcasters, and just Japanese television is fantastic. And let me tell you, it's not all kaiju monster movies and anime. It's not. There's a lot of really wacky stuff on there, and some very good documentaries, and it's, so I had my TV there, my internet and everything, and then you had your air conditioner heater, because you had your air conditioner. It was one of those through-the-wall air conditioners, and then I had the curtain with the doors that would open up, and I had a little balcony that you could actually step out on. And some places had just the balconies where you just opened it up and there was an iron rail there and you could lean and look out your window. But I actually had a balcony that maybe had, that stuck out maybe about 3 feet. And you could sit out there on your balcony. And I had plants out there. I had a cactus, which cactuses aren't very common in Japan at all, but I managed to, what happened was in one of my visits, I had some cactus seeds and I brought them into the country, and I don't know, they're not illegal, but I didn't feel like explaining these are cactus seeds. So I brought them in and I got some potting soil and I had a cactus, and a couple other plants were out there, and sometimes you can hang your laundry out there, too, if you want it. But the balcony was really cool because I'd sit out there and smoke my cigar or my pipe. And I was kind of in one of the outlying districts of Tokyo. But I was near a metro station, so I could get to the center in, like, 20 minutes. And, Tokyo is big. It's gigantic. You don't really get a good sense of the size until you're actually there. But I think a lot of people's perceptions of Tokyo is either based on Fast and Furious, Tokyo Drift, or Godzilla movies, but Tokyo is gigantic. You could literally live in a part of Tokyo and not and go to the roof of your apartment building and not see the rest of the city. It's just so big. But I was lucky because out my window, you could just, because of the way the buildings were placed, and just luck of the draw, at night you could see some of the buildings from like the middle of the city with their neon and everything. And it was a nice view. And, you know, there was you go downstairs and onto the road where the street I lived on, there were shops, and, you know, a couple bars, a couple ramen shops. It was nice. I mean, I enjoyed it. And the thing about living in Japan when you're a gaijin or, you know, somebody who's not Japanese is in the beginning, you know, they kind of are like, you know, look, an American, you know, a non-Japanese person, he's probably here for the anime, blah, 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 because that seems to be a big thing. And if you go on YouTube, I'm sorry, but a lot of the people that live in Japan and that are on YouTube as the Americans or the Brits or the Canadians, they are so obnoxious, and they are so condescending. And, you know, I tried not to be. Like, I would patronize the shops that were on my street, or the ramen shops, or the bars that were on my street. And at first, I don't want to say they give you the cold shoulder, but, you know, they don't know you, you're not Japanese, they're kind of like, yeah, whatever. But after a while, especially if you try speaking the language and you brutally destroy it, after a while they accept you, and after a while it's, you're basically almost one of them. You're never going to be one of them because you're not Japanese, but, you know, in the beginning when I first got there, it was, nobody would even give me the time of day, and then, you know, after a year, everybody's like waving, pat me on the back, and saying good morning, and, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff. And it was like I was part of the neighborhood, I guess. You know, I never really learned Japanese too good at all, other than, you know, kind of, you know, arigato and that type of thing. And I guess I was kind of like the neighborhood American, you know? And once in a while somebody would like just, oh, help me with English, you know, help me English word, and yeah, they would help, you know, they would ask for help with something, I guess their kid in school, or they wanted to know what something meant in English. And, you know, sometimes it was funny because they would come up to me and ask what a racial slur or a sexual term meant, because they didn't know what it meant. I'm like, oh yeah, see, that means, and I would explain it to them, and they would just get this look on their face, and I would explain it more, and I'd have to pull up a picture on my phone, immediately clear my search history and show it to them, and they'd be like, oh yeah. It's like, I miss it. It was a nice life. But I'm back in the United States, and it's good to see friends, good to see family. And one of the first things I did, because I had a life before the podcast, and I always liked having pet snails. I was kind of big into the aquatic snail thing. It's not as popular as goldfish or any type of aquarium and stuff. People, when they think snails, they think escargot, or they think garden snails or pest snails. But aquatic snails come in all different shapes, sizes, styles, colors, and there's many different species. Nerite snails, ramshorn snails, mystery snails, assassin snails, bladder snails, rabbit snails. I mean, there's just all different shells, all different everything. And snails are really cool because unless you have an assassin snail that likes to hunt other things in the tank, snails get along with pretty much anything you put in the tank, as long as it's not a crab, you know. But I usually have mystery snails. Now, mystery snails, there's no mystery about them. That's just their name. Because I guess when they were first described or became popularized, nobody knew what type of snail they were, and you can't tell which one's a male or a female, so it was always a mystery, and I guess the name stuck. And mystery snails come in different shell types. Like you have white ones, blue ones, gold ones, apple snails, you know, a whole bunch of them. I always like golden mystery snails because their shells become like gold. Not real gold, but... And they can get pretty big. I mean, you get them... When they're born, their baby snails are called snabies. And so you get a baby snail less than the size of a pea, at least a mystery snail. And after about 6 months, if you take care of it and feed it, it'll be... The shell area will be bigger than a golf ball. But really, a snail, all it does is it just kind of... It lives underwater. It doesn't come up for air. It's got gills. It can live outside the water for a while, but it lives under the water. And basically, a snail will just crawl along your tank or up and down the glass, eating algae or dead plant material. They keep your... If you have a lot of... What they tell you to do is if you have a fish tank and it's got an algae problem, you put in a couple snails and it'll eat all the algae up. They're very good with that. And, but, you know, they make specialized food for these snails. And I like mystery snails. They're kind of cool. They're cute. They have personality. Believe it or not, snails are personalities. You can have a snail. You can have a mystery snail. You can have two of them. And one of them could just be like, just hangs out in one section of the tank and just goes around. And you can have another snail that's active and is always zooming around. And I used to have a snail that... Because I would have the air bubble in the tank and blow air bubbles up from the stone because it aerates the tank. It's more oxygen. It's good for the flow. And I used to have a mystery snail that loved going into that thing on top of the stone and the bubbles would blow him to the surface and he'd sink back down. He'd crawl back over to the stone and would blow him to the surface, and he would do that a bunch of times a day. He just liked doing it. And I had a mystery snail in there with him who wouldn't go near that thing, but always loved hanging out in the little cave that I have for him. And it was just, they have personalities. And they're very good with shrimp. Now, not shrimp like shrimp cocktail, but there are like cherry shrimp and ghost shrimp and everything. And I've always had ghost shrimp. Ghost shrimp are cool. They're little shrimps that are maybe an inch long. And they're called ghost shrimps because they're transparent. Now, that's not something that was manufactured by humans. They naturally evolved to be transparent because they're invisible in the wild. If fish can't see them because they're transparent. It's perfect camouflage. And so I've always had ghost shrimp. And the ghost shrimp are good because they'll eat the decayed waste. And they keep the tanks clean. And they're very good with the snails. They kind of just... do their shrimpy thing, and the snails in them don't fight. I mean, they just, sometimes the shrimp will sit on the back of the snail, and the snail will take it for a ride, and I have a mystery snail, and his name is Sir Snails a Lot, you know, Sir Mix a Lot, Sir Snails a Lot, and I have a Ramshorn snail, and I have a rabbit snail. Now, a rabbit snail has a Ramshorn snail has a thin shell, and he's brown, and it's a thin shell, not a thick one. All right, so he's thin-shelled, smaller, and they reproduce asexually, which means if they just feel like having eggs, if you're not careful, in a week or two, you're going to have like 50 baby snails running around. It's going to throw your bio load of your tank all off. So you always got to look for the egg deposits and crush them. And sorry, you have to, because they'll go overboard. Mystery snails can also reproduce asexually under certain tank conditions, and I don't keep my tank warm enough for him to do. And if they do, it's a clutch, and you can just take the clutch out, and they say the best way to dispose of that is just put it in a freezer, freeze it, and then throw it out. Or just flush it down the toilet, whatever. But, you know, you could sell mystery snails on eBay for, like, you know, $5 a pop. So I'm thinking, oh, okay. And then I have a rabbit snail. Now, a rabbit snail is different because their shells are long. Rabbit snails can get up to, like, 3 or 4 inches long. And rabbit snails are cool because they have a very long shell. And, you know, most of the snail resides in the shell. So when the rabbit snail's head is out of the shell... you know, the foot's on the bottom of it, they kind of look like a rabbit because of their antenna, and they kind of, when they go along the sand, it's like they're hopping. Like, most snails just kind of glide along the bottom of the tank, but rabbit snails, because of the shell, they have to pull themselves along, and it's like they're hopping, because the shell will hop up, they'll pull themselves forward, the shell will hop up, and they pull themselves forward. And I have a rabbit snail now, but he's weird because he likes hanging out in one corner of the tank near the air stone. Or actually, she, because she just had a baby. And the good thing about rabbit snails is they don't reproduce asexually. You need to have a male and a female, or they will not reproduce. So they're very good to have if you don't want baby snails. Unfortunately, the one I bought must have been pregnant and had a snail. Had a snaby. So now I have a snaby. But they'll never have another one because it's not going to be able to reproduce. Well, unless the one it had grows up to be a male, and there's no way of knowing. So I have them, and I bought a betta. You know, those Siamese fighting fish. Bettas are very good with snails because they don't hunt the snails. They don't hunt the shrimp. And snails and shrimp like living among plants and stuff. That's their thing. Bettas love that because in the wild, they use the plants and everything to hide from the bigger fish. So if you have a tank with snails and shrimp, you're supposed to have like a lot of plants and a couple moss balls and maybe a cave. It's perfect for the bettas. If you take care of a betta fish, it'll live up to 8 years. And so I got a betta fish. He's only like 6 months old. I named him Mr. Grumpy, because he kind of looks grumpy. And so he's in there with the snails, and I'll watch him, and sometimes he'll go up to the ghost shrimp, and the ghost shrimp are just kind of like, you know, he's not going to hunt them. He's just, the bettas are very curious, so he'll go up to the ghost shrimp and just, say the ghost shrimp are on the bottom of the sand, and the bettas are weird because they'll kind of glide along the bottom of the tank almost like they're walking, and like he'll kind of like go up to the shrimp and they'll just like stare at each other like they're having a staring contest, and then Mr. Grumpy will just like checking out the snails. But bettas are cool because they like living among the vegetation and everything. But I ordered some Indian almond leaves. They put tannin in the water, which is good for the bacterial load of the water. It adds nutrients. It does some other stuff that's very good for shrimp and bettas and snails. So I ordered some from eBay. And they're very good because the bettas like having vegetation over them, because that's what they have in the wild. And I don't have any at my tank, but now I'm going to. And bettas will actually build a bubble nest. Now, I've never seen one in real life. I've seen it on YouTube, but somehow they make a bubble nest out of sticky bubbles, and they'll kind of like hang out in there. So, whatever. So, Mr. Grumpy's going to have all that. So, I got this tank and everything, and those are my. So, now I got some pets. I really want a basset hound, but I'm not in a position to have a basset hound. So, maybe if you all hit the support button on Spotify and start sending me some money, I can afford to actually do that sort of thing. And there you go. You know? You gotta start sending me money, because I need money. Alright? And remember, you can email me at victims... shut up. See, somebody's texting me. I've only been back for like 4 days and people are texting me like crazy. So, remember, you can follow me at Victims of Fun on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can email me at victimsoffun@mail.com. You can listen to us on Spotify, on Anchor, on Pandora, and a whole bunch of other platforms. Just make sure you hit that support button and start sending me some cash, which would be very good. And so we're going to take a little commercial break, and I will be back. Thank you very much. I hope you all like snails, because I didn't know I was going to be talking about snails. Okay. And welcome back to part two of season five, episode one of Victims of Fun, live from somewhere on the Gulf Coast of Florida. You can hear the waves hitting in the background, the seagulls flying through the air. I'm at a beach club. You can probably hear some of the music in the background. And remember, you can email me at victimsoffun@mail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just do a search for Victims of Fun. Listen to us on Anchor or Spotify or Pandora or many other great podcast providers, hosts, whatever you want to call them. Remember, you can hit that supporter button and you can start sending me money because I would like some money. I need money and you don't. So you should send me your money. And you should send me your money like right now. So, one of the things I noticed when I got back here was nobody drives a stick shift. I remember living in Europe, everybody drove a stick shift. And in Asia and Japan anyway, most people drive a stick shift. And I remember living in Europe and, you know, there were four-door sedans and station wagons with stick shifts. And here, the only things that have stick shifts are like performance cars and little Econo boxes like Mitsubishi Mirages and Chevy Sparks. Nobody drives a stick anymore. Everybody's all automatic. And I remember back in the day, at least, you know, I'm going to be 53. I remember back in the day, like in high school and everything, an automatic transmission was an option. Everything came stick shift, unless you were driving like a big sedan, like a Impala or a Caprice or a Lincoln Town Car or Crown Vic or Grand Marquis or something like that. Everything was stick shift. And even back then, air conditioning was an option, unless you were driving a more expensive model car. I mean, nobody drove an automatic. And I'm wondering if people have just gotten so used to not driving a stick anymore that they don't even know how. Because one of the selling points of a stick shift was, other than the fact that it's more fun to drive and you have more control over the vehicle, was your gas mileage was better. Because an automatic transmission kind of requires more of gasoline than a stick shift, because you're doing it yourself. And one of the things was, oh, you know, this car gets 45 miles a gallon with a stick shift and 38 with an automatic. You know, back then when gas was 50 cents a gallon, I guess people didn't care. But now I'm thinking to myself, you know, it'd be a good idea maybe for everybody who's driving a stick shift. You know, and air conditioning was an option. I actually had a brand new car back then that didn't have air conditioning. It was a Hyundai Excel. I think it was an 89 or a 91 or something. And the base model was a stick shift, no radio, and no air conditioning. Manual windows. You had to actually crank them. And it was a good little car. It got like 50 miles of the gallon. But, you know, I put my own radio and speakers in, and the problem was no air conditioning. You know, I that is the one thing, like, at least, you know, if I had a car that was a stick shift, I wouldn't care. If it had crank windows, I'd be like, yeah, whatever. But man, you gotta have air conditioning. You remember, I my first car, you know, that Pinto I had, manual steering, like no power steering, no power brakes, had an automatic, had no air conditioning, manual windows. I mean, it was a lot of work to drive it, but it was fun. And I had a Saturn SL1, and you know that had air conditioning, but it didn't have. It had crank windows, and it had a 5-speed stick shift, and that was a lot of fun to drive. I enjoyed driving that car. It was a lot of fun. And I can't see driving like a big, like, what's a big car? I mean, nobody makes big cars anymore. But like, I guess a Lincoln Town Car or Chevy Impala, you know, you know, no stick shift. Well, everything's automatic. Well, now you have this thing that's a paddle shift. Like, where you can put it in paddle shift mode, like on an F1 car, you'll have the paddle shifters on the steering wheel. And some of the cars will have an automatic, but they'll have a mode you could put it in manual mode. And on the automatic shifter is a button, plus and minus, up and down, and you can shift that way without a clutch. I don't think it's as fun. Because the whole thing about driving was, you know, you slam on the clutch and throw it back in the first, throw it in second, like your speed racer. You know? And, but I don't even know if people know how to drive stuff like that. And I remember my uncles and my father telling me that back in the day they had, you know, you had shifting on the stalk. So instead of on the floor where the shifter was, this was on the stalk. The steering wheel next to, I guess, where we're used to having the windshield wiper thing. And you shifted that, and it was usually a 3-speed and sometimes a 4. And I can't even remember the pattern. I remember trying to drive a truck that had a shifter on the, and I couldn't get it out of second gear. I just couldn't figure out how to do it, because you're throwing the thing in a pattern that, all right, when you have your hand on the shifter and it's on the floor, you look down, you could see the pattern. Up, down, up, right, up, down, down, up, all the way to right, down or up, reverse, or whatever. Okay, so you had that. But, you know, how you drove it on a I'm trying to remember the pattern on a stalk was pull back, up, one, down, push forward, down, up, two, something like that. And I remember having this conversation with my Uncle Tom about it, and he was explaining to me the shift pattern. And, you know, and this guy's a car enthusiast, and even he was like, well, wait a minute, no, was it shift up and down and pull? But I don't understand how people drove back then. And I remember there were some cars back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that push button transmission, so you didn't even have an automatic lever to put it in park, reverse, or drive. You had buttons on the dashboard, and you hit P for park and R for reverse, and you're like, oh my god. You know, it's just, but nobody knows how to drive a stick anymore. I bet you if you put people in a stick shift car now, you'd have a lot of blown up transmissions. Seriously, you know, it's just, I don't know why people can't handle something like that, but driving a stick shift was always a lot of fun. You had more control over it. Going, idling on a hill was always interesting, especially if you couldn't put the emergency brake on. But see, what you do is you would put it in neutral and just sit there with your foot on the brake, and it was time to go, and you just throw it in first and take off, and then going downhill and downshifting, you know, if you want to, it was a lot of fun. But, you know, I remember back in the day, you could pop the hood on your car and change your spark plugs and your oil and your air filter and your brake fluid and radiator fluid. And, you know, if you're halfway handy, you could do that stuff yourself. Now you pop the hood of your car and there's a plastic cover and a sign that says, you shouldn't be touching this, there's nothing here you need. I mean, I don't even know if you can check the oil in your car anymore. The car tells you. Like, they have like an on-screen thing that says, hey, you know, you're almost out of oil. And, I remember back in the day, you had the dipstick, and I was like, oh, God, does this say I need oil? I can't really tell. Maybe I do. The only warning light you got was if you were overheating, and then you were lucky if the thermostat even worked. And we used to get around that by just taking the thermostat out, which is, you know, because I guess this is how it was, but. And it's weird is, you know, my 74 Pinot got 35 miles of the gallon. And, you know, the old Mac transmission was heavy. It's solid steel. No plastic on those cars. Carburetor. A bigger four-cylinder engine with much less technology in 1974. It was getting 35 miles a gallon, and then you have cars today that have every single safety and fuel-efficient thing that our government said they have to have, and they're not getting 35 miles to the gallon. I'm thinking to myself, well, what happened? You know, why is this? Why was my old beat-up piece of junk Pinto able to pull 35 miles a gallon, and these new cars with all this stuff added into it can't? Oh, it can tell me if there's somebody in my lane, but it's not getting good gas mileage. And I remember the Popular Mechanics magazines that used to lay around the shop class in the high school I went to from like, they were like from the 60s and stuff, and saying, oh, you know, by the year 2000, we'll be living on the moon and cars will be flying. Well, it's 2021. Where the hell is my flying car? Why am I not living on the moon? You know, according to them, traveling from Earth to the moon would be like the equivalent of hopping on a plane and going from, like, Florida to New Jersey. That's how it was supposed to be by now. There should be cities on the moon, and we should be already having colonists on Mars. But, you know, there's nothing going on. We're, like, stuck on this racially divided rock that is slowly falling apart because everybody hates each other here, and we should be living in space. You know? Yeah, I want my moon house. I want to live in my moon city and have my moon apartment and look out the window and see, you know, like the Earth. I mean, I don't know what kind of job you'd have on the moon. I guess it would be the same thing. Like, it'd be like living in a giant shop. Because you couldn't live outside on the moon like you do at Earth. So you'd be living under a dome or in an enclosed environment. So it would almost be like living inside a shopping mall or a hotel that you could never go outside of. But, you know, so what? You're living on the moon. And I guess if you want to go outside, you put your spacesuit on and you just go. And, because I don't think you can terraform the moon. I know they used to talk about terraforming Mars, that there was some plans that they would start, introducing, because there's ice and water on Mars, and they were thinking that there might be certain algae and stuff that could survive the Martian environment, and that they wanted to start planting it there because it would start creating, you know, the oxygen exchange for the atmosphere, and would start creating ozone for the ozone layer, which isn't there, which is your radiation shield. And over a course of a couple generations, you know, they would have an atmosphere that, you know, and a temperature scheme that would be breathable for humans. But then I said the big problem is Mars's magnetic core is not active. It doesn't have a magnetic core. Like, the core of the Earth is molten iron or nickel or something, and it's molten. It's spinning, and that creates the magnetic field of the Earth that blocks cosmic rays and stuff from the sun. It shields the Earth. Mars doesn't have that. The core is inactive. So I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, so if they terraform Mars, but you don't have a active core, how the hell are you going to block all the cosmic rays coming down here, the photons or whatever, that would kill you? And I guess, you know, I did some more reading, and they had this idea that they would drill down to the core of Mars and detonate a bunch of nuclear bombs and get the core spinning again. But then they were saying, well, if we did that and we got the core spinning again, golly knows what's going to do to the orbit of Mars, and, you know, it might change the orbit and send it right at Earth. So who knows? Then they talked about Venus, and they said Venus is probably a better candidate to terraform than Mars, even though it's closer to the sun, because the greenhouse gases and everything you need are already there. It's just there's so much of it. And that if they, I forget what the plan was to do something. To start cleaning the atmosphere up. And they said once they did, Venus already has an active core and everything else. It's just it has a runaway greenhouse gas effect. But if you got that under control and built up your ozone layer and everything, you would have a livable environment. It would just be extremely hot. They said, again, you might have to live in domes because it might be just too hot to live outside. Almost like hotter than, not something where you would walk out and instantly burst into flames, but like, you know, I think the hottest recorded temperature on Earth was 120 something, and they said that with Venus it'd be like 135 140, so you could survive in it, but man, you would be very, very hot, and most people couldn't take it. So, but at least you have an environment, and there's some plant life apparently that can handle that. And the whole idea was I guess you'd have a planet of cactuses or something, or cockroaches, because cockroaches can live in anything. There's cockroaches apparently living in the melted core of Chernobyl. Because I guess they said something about, like, radiation doesn't kill cockroaches. But I've seen enough monster movies to know what happens when you expose an animal to too much radiation. That's how, like, monsters are born. Like Megalon. From Godzilla, he's a giant cockroach, and I'm just thinking, you know, he was a simple little cockroach living his life, got irradiated, next thing you know, he's Megalon, and just whatever, he's just killing people. And so apparently the Kentucky Derby winner was high as tripping balls on drugs, and apparently this horse had taken steroids, or the horse version of steroids, or the horse version of meth, I don't know. But this horse was all on a whole bunch of shit. And he may be getting disqualified. And the guy who trained him, I guess this guy was going for his 7th Kentucky Derby winner, it'd be a record. And now he may be banned for life from horse racing, which, yeah, I was reading online, people were saying, well, it probably doesn't matter to him because he's got so much money already, you know, so what, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, horse racing is a very, especially at that level, thoroughbred, like Kentucky Derby type stuff, it's a very small, cliquish group, and they don't like outsiders. You have to really be, I don't want to say old money, but you had to have been in the game for a long time before they consider you part of their little group, like, say Jeff Bezos decides to buy a thoroughbred farm and a horse and throws $400 million at it and wins the Kentucky Derby, they would never accept him as part of their group because of just how he did it. And somebody was saying that it would be worse for this guy, this trainer, I think his last name is Baffert or something, they said it'd be worse for him to get banned from horse racing than if you find him all the money he has, take all his horses away, and sell all his real estate. Because to people like him, it's more important that social circle than it is the money. And if they ban him for life, you know, it's not just him, it's his family, it's his kids, you know. Suddenly your scholarships for your kids disappear. Suddenly their kids' friends don't want to be with them anymore. Suddenly that job that your cousin had is suddenly gone because, you know. So he didn't just ruin himself. He ruined his whole family. That's if they prove he did. I mean, the horse tested positive, but he's claiming that's impossible. So according to the rules, they have to do another test from a different sample in a different lab, and if it matches up, then he's screwed. And that's kind of what they're waiting on now. I remember being young, going to the racetrack with my mom and my aunts and uncles and my grandfather and everything. And we'd go to Monmouth or Atlantic City mostly and watch the horse races. And my mom and I always had this tradition where we watched the Kentucky Derby together, whether in person or over FaceTime or something. And it's the only time we really watched horse racing is for the Triple Crown or the Kentucky Derby. And, I always liked horse racing. I was always afraid. My mother's always the same way. She's like, oh, God, I'm always afraid that the horses are going to fall and they're going to get hurt. And, yeah, that's always, I don't like seeing that type of thing where the horses, because usually if a horse, I mean, back in the old days, if a horse broke its leg, they shot it on sight. But I guess now, because I did some reading on it, and I guess now if a horse breaks its leg, they're at a point where they can, you know, it'll never race again, but it's not a death sentence. They can kind of reinforce it or cast it. Or I think one horse has a prosthetic leg and it's doing just fine. So it's not an automatic death sentence anymore. I guess veterinary science has come a long way. I have a friend who has a little shih tzu that's had like 6 different forms of cancer. And, you know, I had a little dog that died of that when I was in high school. And the vet was like, well, you know, she was only 8 years old. And the vet's like, there's no treatment for this. There's nothing. I mean, and flash forward now, and my friend's little dog, Baxter, you know, they were able to treat it. And, you know, it's not a death sentence anymore for these animals. You know, there's that dolphin in Clearwater, Florida, that's got prosthetic fins. I don't know if it was born, I guess its fin got cut off, or it was in a movie called The Dolphin's Tale, and so I guess this dolphin lost its back tail fins or something, and, you know, that's a death sentence for a dolphin, because that's what they use to propel themselves through the water to keep themselves afloat. And so they made a prosthetic out of carbon fiber or rubber or something, and they attached it to the dolphin. And I mean, the dolphin lives in the aquarium now, but the dolphin is absolutely fine. It zooms around, and I've seen on YouTube, they've done this with sea turtles. They'll find a sea turtle, it's got a big gash out of its shell, and they have some sort of mixture, polymer concrete type of thing, and they'll patch it, and they'll dye it to look like the color of the shell, and then the turtle lives for the next 500 million years, however long they live, and they're fine. And they even did one for an American eagle that lost the half of it, the top of its beak, and they made a prosthetic. I mean, the eagle lives in a zoo now, but it's perfectly fine. It's got like this stainless steel beak. And they did the same thing for some alligator, and just they can do all that stuff now. And back in the old days, I guess that was a death sentence for the animals. And veterinary science has come quite a long way. And I just wish it was around when my little dog was sick back in high school. I would have liked to have had her around for more than 8 years. That would have been nice. I know dogs that are like, I think my uncle's dachshund Willie lived to be 18 or something. The dog he has now, Lily, the little Yorkshire Terrier, is 15. My other friend's pug is 14. You know, they're living a lot longer. I mean, I told you about a couple episodes ago about Fred, my goldfish. And Fred lived more than 10 years. I mean, Fred lived from 80... When did Fred live? Fred lived from 88 to 2000. So, yeah, he was like 12 years old when he lived. You know, Fred lived a long time. He had a good life. He was the only one in the tank, but, you know, it was all his. It's Fred's world. You know, and it's, I saw on YouTube this woman's got a pet turtle, and she got the turtle when she was 15, and she's like 80 now, and the turtle's still alive, and the vet said that turtle could live another 40 years, so she had to put it in the will. That turtle has to go to the granddaughter. The granddaughter's like, I'll take care of the turtle. And the woman's like, yeah, the turtle's going to live longer than me. I've had a turtle since I was 15. I forget the turtle's name. If you go on YouTube, you just just look for, like, old lady and pet turtle, and you'll see the story on it. It's pretty cool. I wouldn't mind having a pet turtle. I remember, and this is a true story, when we first moved to the Jersey Shore, there was a box turtle, because that part of New Jersey, they have a lot of box turtles, and we found a box turtle that had, like, a really bad eye infections. And their eye, this turtle's eyes were, like, covered in pus and everything else. And we took him in. And I'm just young, and I think my father called the vet, or somebody did, and they found out, well, you can do this to try to help it, and I guess they washed it or gave it something, and after a couple of weeks, the turtle's eyes cleared up, and so we took some paint, and we painted my initials and the date on the bottom of on the belly of the turtle, and we let him go, and then, this is a true story, every year for like 3 years, the turtle would come wandering back in the yard, and like, is that the turtle? And pick him up, and there it was, and we'd bring him in the house in a box for a couple weeks and then let him go, and it was kind of like a vacation, I guess, you know? It's weird, animals sometimes do some weird things that, like, you didn't think they would. Like, I've seen videos on YouTube, like, there's the shark, and it's a nurse shark or something, and it recognizes this, and this is a wild shark, so this isn't even in the zoo or aquarium. But this nurse shark just lives in this one reef somewhere, and that's where it's always lived. And there's this one diver that every time this one diver is in the water, this nurse shark comes barreling towards it and is like rubbing up against it like it wants hugs, and the diver will hug it and everything. And this nurse shark, this is the only person this nurse shark goes to. It's like, and I've seen a video of it, and this nurse shark will just go zoom right up to the person. And this thing's like 6 feet long, and the diver's hugging it, and the nurse shark's there, like, it's weird that animals would do that. There's a couple of videos online of people who raised lions from a cub, and then they're released back in the wild, and like 5 years later, the people go to the park where the lion was released in the wild, and the lion will see the owner and come zooming over like it's going to attack them, but then it goes into all like kitten mode and is like hugging the ex-owner or the ex-caretaker and like wants belly rubs. And I saw one where the two guys who raised the lion from a kitten or cub hadn't seen her for years, and the lion was a female lion, and she saw them and she comes running over. And they start playing that Whitney Houston song, I Will Always Love You. And this lion comes barreling into them, knocks them both over, and is jumping on them and being all kitten and everything. And then the lion goes into the bushes and for like a minute and comes out, and it's got its two cubs. And they say that like in the wild, a mother lion, you know, nothing gets near the cubs. They'll kill anything or anybody that gets near them. But this lion brought these cubs over to her ex-caretakers, I guess she trusted them. There's like her parent, and brought her own cubs over to meet the two guys who raised her. And gorillas are big on that too. I've seen a lot of videos where, you know, they'll raise a chimpanzee or a gorilla from an infant and put it in the wild, and you know, years later, the ex-trainer and everything, the gorilla will see it because they'll go back to visit or just whatever. And, like, they always recognize them and everything. And, you know, animals are a lot smarter and a lot more intuitive than people give them credit for. I mean, you think your dog or your cat, you know, knows who you are. But imagine having that kind of effect on a lion or a shark or a rhino or an elephant or a gorilla. That's got to be cool, you know? Yeah. Your cat's real. Yeah, your cat or your dog's real friendly. But why don't we go to a Gatorland? I want you to meet old Bob. And a old Bob, the 15-foot alley here, comes charging out of the pool up to you, flips on its back and wants belly rubs because you raised it from when it hatched. Yeah, that'd be the greatest thing in the world. That'd be cool. You never know. You know, animals are very good with reading people. They instinctively know good people from bad people. I wish human beings had that ability, especially in this world we live in now that just seems like it's falling apart more and more and more with so much hatred and so much division. You know, it's like maybe instead of all that, we should be like the animals and just, you know, just try to be better. I mean, animals, you know, they'll eat each other, they'll hunt each other or whatever, but they're not screwing each other over. They're not stealing land from them. They're not stealing resources from them. They're not enslaving them or committing genocide on them. You know, animals are animals. You know, we think we're the higher life form, but we're the only life form on the planet that, you know, we'll try to genocide another group of people just because they have a different skin color or worship a different god or were born in a different part of the world. I mean, the animals don't do shit like that. Only we do. And we're supposed to be the evolved ones? No, we're not. I think if aliens came down and, like, somehow saw the behavior of every species on Earth and didn't know that humans were, you know, the apex on the planet, aliens would be like, oh, this is a nice place, but these human people, that, God, these animals are garbage. We should, like, do the rest of the world a favor and just kill them. I mean, seriously, you gotta be careful. You know, if aliens ever show up, they don't know what's going on here. And they're just gonna look at us and assume that we're destroying the planet, because we are, because you don't see the aliens dumping, I mean, you don't see the animals dumping toxins into the water or anything else or anything. Just us. Food for thought. So, thank you for listening to Victims of Fun this week. Remember, you can mail me at victimsoffun@mail.com. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook by searching for Victims of Fun. And you can listen to us on Anchor or Spotify or Pandora. And make sure you hit the support button. Start sending me some cash because you're all cheap. And I need your money. Give me your money. So thank you for listening, and maybe we'll have some more interesting stuff to talk about next time. I mean, I enjoyed it, and if you did, great. If not, you know, go listen to somebody else. All right, have a good day. Love each other. Bye-bye.